KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, San Francisco writer and creativity coach Eric Maisel, author of A Writer's San Francisco, will be joining us for a wide-ranging discussion all about writing and creativity and reflections on why San Francisco has long been a writer's town. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. It's our second hour. And Eric Maisel is joining us this hour. He's a teacher and a family therapist and the author of 30 books, as well as someone who trains and coaches in the world of creativity. His books include A Writer's Paris, The Van Gogh Blues, or as my art history pedantic friend used to say, Van Gogh Blues, and Coaching the Artist Within. He recently published a book called A Writer San Francisco, A Guided Journey for the Creative Soul, and he joins us for this second hour forum. Good to have you here.
Great to be here.
Well, I should mention that this is a very local book. In fact, before we begin our interview with Eric, he talks about his home in Bernal Heights, which he describes as the dog-friendliest San Francisco neighborhood with great views from his Edwardian home there. And a lot of local color in this book, a lot about writers who are connected to San Francisco. And this is a man who describes himself as an urban writer by nature. Could be in just about any big city, at least from what we gleaned from his prose, but also a creativity coach. Before we talk about writing, I want to find out, creativity coach. Now, the only thing I got out of this was affirmations and egg breaking. So help me understand what it is you do.
Well, I've been working as a creativity coach for maybe 15 years now. I'm also a therapist, and I segued out of therapy to creativity coaching because I prefer to work with creative clients, and I didn't think they were necessarily mentally ill, just eccentric and interesting and suffering from the normal problems of living. What a creativity coach does is help creative people with all of the things that come up, whether it's blockage or career issues or even things like mood difficulties. There are a whole array of special challenges that creative people face, and creativity coaches are hopefully well-trained in dealing with those particular challenges.
What are the people who come to you who want to be more creative and they're not? I imagine you see some of that, don't you?
You see it a lot, but I don't leap to the conclusion, of course, that they're not. I more leap to the conclusion that they've probably kept their mind so busy that they have trouble even knowing if they're creative. So I come first from the cognitive place of trying to get people to quiet their minds and improve their self-talk and do those kinds of things so that ideas have a chance to percolate in their brain. Most people, when they say they don't have an idea, probably don't have an idea, not because they're not intelligent enough to have ideas, but because they're thinking about so many other kinds of things that prevent ideas from percolating.
Well, you have a profile of an eye surgeon, for example, in your book. I mean, this is someone who is obviously very busy professionally, but wanted to have something more come out of his creative maw.
Mm-hmm. And there, I think it's a big point. There, we want our eye surgeons not to make mistakes and messes, and he was a fastidious person and probably a wonderful eye surgeon. But when it comes to doing our creative work, we have to turn our mind around and allow mistakes and messes to happen. And that was very hard for him to do, and it's very hard for a lot of, so to speak, perfectionistic, careful, anal people to do, to allow mistakes and messes to happen. And in our day jobs, we don't want that to happen. We want to be able to balance our checkbooks and, you know, not make mistakes. And then something very different has to happen when we turn ourselves over to that hour of creating.
You bring out, or try to bring out the more Dionysian as well as the Apollonian side, something like that. In fact, I was interested in how this is a San Francisco book. It's about writers coming to San Francisco and has all kinds of quotes, and we'll get into that. As you say, most of them know the seedier part of San Francisco before they get to know San Francisco as a whole. But there's a sense here, for example, you write about a publisher coming to a party that you had, and there were all these artists or would-be artists behind the roles of investment bankers or nonprofit directors or software project managers. In other words, it's the inner artist or the artist who's kind of kept at bay in order to make a living that right. you see in so many people in this town. And it's always been the case, at least probably up until recently always been the case.
That's right. And many people make that decision in college often and or in graduate school, where they have to make the choice between being a fine artist or a graphic artist or a writer or an investment banker. They make those kinds of choices. Then they have to live with that choice. They often do very well, you know, running nonprofits or doing whatever it is they do, but they have that longing to express themselves and to manifest their potential. And so they try to do that on the side, and often it's a very rocky road to try to manifest your potential on the side, so to speak. And so they're much more comfortable, it's much more natural for them to talk about technology or whatever their day job is. And so I tried to host a party where people could come disguised as their other selves, as their creative selves, and people love that opportunity. They would love to be that other part of themselves more often than they get to be.
And as you say, this seems to be endemic in some ways to San Francisco postal inspectors and real estate agents who aspire to or have burning within their heart some sense of what they would like to do with creativity.
I think it's also because we have, apart from Washington, D.C., which is an anomaly because of government, but apart from Washington, D.C., we have the most educated workforce in the nation. So we have people with lots of degrees and lots of advanced degrees doing those things for which their degrees train them to do. But because of that education, they know other things, and they would like to be doing other things as well.
Learned another interesting statistic in your book, 13th in population of big city San Francisco, but third in book buying, which
right.
didn't surprise me, since we know.
I think it's also third in drinking. I think I remember that from somewhere, too.
Those two go together, too.
I think so.
Talking to Eric Maisel again, his new book is A Writer's San Francisco, A Guided Journey for the Creative Soul. You talk a lot about a cafe, particularly in your neighborhood over in Bernal Heights, and the cafe where you go in and I think I know who the author is, somebody who, you know, he's an artist, he knows you're an artist, or at least both aspiring writers, but there's nothing that's exchanged in the way of communication. And the implication of that, subtextually to some extent, is maybe that's what makes you serious writers, as opposed to people who talk about their writing or talk about their artistry, which is something that goes on ad infinitum among people in this particular neck of the woods.
That's exactly right. I always thought of him as the other serious writer in the cafe. There were lots of would-be writers chatting about writing, and then he would be doing his work and I would be doing my work. And I thought we were attempting to hold it as our office in the world, and we each knew that we shouldn't be intruding on the other person's office. And I must have seen him for maybe 5 or 6 or 7 consecutive years at the same cafe. It was actually the Owl and the Monkey Cafe in the Sunset many years ago, which isn't there anymore. And so we both used the cafe that way as our office in the world, and we knew sort of not to bother each other.
Did do a book about earthquake, the earthquake, which is why I think I've managed to figure out who he is. He's unnamed in here. But you say writers in general live in what you describe as perpetual earthquake country. What do you mean?
Well, it's really a funny business. We all understand how difficult it is to write, but we're attempting to quiet our brain enough that our billions of neurons can come together and create something new. And even while we're trying to do that quieting of the brain, we have to take care of all of our responsibilities and the everyday business of life. And all of those responsibilities and errands and chores create just enough little earthquakes that our neurons are grabbed from doing the work we would love them to do the creating. So that's all I mean by that earthquake metaphor, is that we're always being deflected and distracted from the work we would like to do by everyday things. And that's fine if we're living an everyday life. But if we're hoping to go deep into our writing, it isn't okay that we get deflected by those things. And that's why I spend so much time when I train coaches and when I work with clients on cognitive matters and mindfulness matters and even meditation matters.
But you're trying to calm them down. And some would say artists need to be percolating. They need to have
They need to be wild and calm simultaneously. I mean, it's hard in words to describe the state. You want to vanish into the work, which is a kind of calmness, and then you want lots of wild things to happen when you've vanished. So it sounds a little paradoxical or difficult to express. But I think the calmness comes before the wildness. If you're wild all the time, then you're probably got an addiction, you probably got chaos going on in you. It's probably too much going on in your life that's preventing you from doing the work. And, you know, it's the American writer's story that they can do work in their teens and 20s often fairly well, but then those qualities of personality that are chaotic start to take over. That's why so many American writers have their addictions later in life, their writing goes downhill later in life. It's a very typical American story.
But I'm thinking even of somebody like, Dorothy Allison, local writer, comes to mind, who needs to have, I remember her telling me she needs to be pumped up with music, particularly a kind of, fervid music, you know, that she absorbs and that gets her adrenaline going. And
It's not contradictory at all, and that's right. I think we canalize our energy often in the midst of that kind of noise the best. Lots of poets have written about that need to have that tumult around them in order to grow quiet, but it's still for the sake of getting quiet. It's not noise for noise's sake. There are a lot of people who like noise for noise's sake. It's actually noise so that something gets blocked out. It's a noise that blocks out other noise so that we can quiet in that space.
So in your title, you talk about the creative soul. I mean, there's a sense that the soul is involved in this. Are we talking mystically here about something, you know, beyond the body?
I think I'm just using that as another way of talking about human potential and the best of the species and those kinds of ideas. I'm not talking about it in any particular spiritual bent. I'm not a religious person. I'm probably an anti-religious person. So I think I mean soul in that. In the same way that we use, I think, Zen in an everyday way, Zen is a word I like too, but not with its religious associations, just in the sense of mindfulness and detachment and those kinds of ideas that have filtered down when we use a word like Zen.
There is a good deal of connection early on in your book between San Francisco and Paris, and you've written a book about Paris, and you talk about Ferlinghetti's bookstore, for example, City Lights, and how it connects back to Paris, the City of Lights, and how San Francisco and Paris have become kind of bohemian meccas, I guess, as you see it.
Right.
Or were bohemian meccas.
That's right. I use the metaphor of the international bohemian highway. That is that there are places where writers know that they want to be. They may not get there, or they may not get there for long periods of time. They may be stuck wherever they are for good reasons with their responsibilities in their everyday life. But I think the world's great cities, and especially Paris, London, New York, the Greenwich Village of New York, San Francisco, those places have always attracted creative people. And creative people know that when they go there, the person next to them, first of all, there's going to be a cafe. And the person next to them at the cafe is probably going to be a semi-interesting person. And that helps them do their own work. Even if they're not talking to the person next to them, they know that they're in the right environment or the right milieu. And they also know that there's a kind of general unspoken permission to be free in these places, to be idiosyncratic, to be eccentric, to wear your Basque beret if you want to, but just to be your artist self. And they also know that there is much more internal and external censorship that happens in places other than those great cities, and that's why they know often not to be in those places.
Well, a couple of the people who wound up in Paris that you talk about in your book, of course, are Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas, and a lot of people are going to be surprised to find out about those fascist sympathies that they had.
Right. I don't even know how I came to be thinking about that. I was writing an essay about the Chaise Lounge, which actually no longer exists. It existed just some months ago, but as things happen, it's turned over. And that was a woman's bar, a woman-friendly bar on our main street in Bernal Heights. And I was thinking about the necessity of these places existing so that women can feel safe in certain kinds of bars. And somehow that segued in my mind to thinking about Alice B. Toklas and
Gertrude Stein. Woman-friendly is a euphemism for a lesbian bar?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, it's a natural segue. They were lesbians. They were lovers.
Exactly. And then I started looking them up on the Internet. I really didn't know much about them. And then I began to learn about their fascist sympathies. And
despite being Jewish. You
know. Despite being Jewish and lesbians and from this area. And they, so to speak, should have known better. And it struck me. I guess that's what struck me the most, is they should have known better. Or rather, it's interesting how personality works, that even if you are the kind of person who might face the most danger from a certain set of circumstances, you still might not be on the right side of the equation.
In all deference, they may not have known of the danger. And
I think they did know.
Well, there's a whole different notion that came through in the subtext of mm-hmm. your writing about seeing Stein with her short haircut and thinking of it as a kind of an Aryan butch haircut as opposed to, you know, the old androgynous idea that it's associated with. But
they were even breaking well-known fascists out of jail. I mean, they were supplying money for that. So I think they chose sides to protect themselves, and because they were a little high and mighty, and they were a little on the side of royalty, so to speak. And so that was the way to be a royalty of that moment.
I'm thinking of that fascinating piece that Susan Sontag did about fascist art, where she was taking on Leni Riefenstahl. We were just talking about photography in the last hour, and you know, Stein would have been appalled at that kind of idea or that sort of iconization of the body that's all linked to, or maybe she wouldn't have been. Who knows? We'll have some Stein aficionados maybe coming in during the phone call part of this hour. But the thing that you hit on in terms of the big cities, the cosmopolitan towns like San Francisco and Paris, is people in those towns, not only often artists, interesting people, but they prefer cafes to malls, which I found kind of a curious dichotomy. I mean, you think about big cities throughout the United States, you don't think about cafes. You do think about malls often.
Right. But I do think it is the abundance and just the mere existence of cafes. Because, as we spoke about a little while ago, often a writer, certainly at the beginning of her career, and especially if she's doing the average day job that most writers do, is a poor person. And so she's probably in a small studio, not in a big house, and she actually needs more space. And so the cafe, for many writers, have become the living rooms of their life and the place they can go to get out of the wall shrinking of their studio. So it serves really just on a sort of mechanical level as extra space for writers. And it's a kind of extra space that doesn't exist outside of the great cities.
Talking with Eric Maisel, his book is called A Writer's San Francisco, A Guided Journey for the Creative Soul, with drawings by Paul Madonna, and with some quotes here. In fact, a whole section of quotes about San Francisco you learn throughout this book, of all sorts of fascinating, the sort of things that you might not have come across in your readings or whatever your knowledge might be. Rudyard Kipling's love of San Francisco women, for example, was certainly something new that I didn't know. And here are all these quotes that many of you probably know. Mark Twain: "This struggling town shall be a vast metropolis as any other city, a future like San Francisco." Imogen Cunningham: "I think San Francisco is the best place in the whole world for an easy life." Dylan Thomas: "San Francisco is incredibly beautiful, all hills and bridges and blinding blue sky and boats in the Pacific Ocean. I am madly unhappy, but I love it here."
that's a great favorite.
Well, my favorite is Oscar Wilde, as often is the case with quotes. "It is an odd thing," said Oscar Wilde, "but everyone who disappears is said to be seen in San Francisco. It must be a delightful city and possess all the attractions of the next world." What more can you say?
That's right.
You also talk about San Francisco writers as being satiric. You bring in The Onion, which I found a little curious since it's published in Madison, Wisconsin, but you talk about Ambrose Bierce and Tom Wolfe and H.L. Mencken and of course Twain.
Right.
Not that Mencken and Wolfe were San Franciscans, but they certainly had an identity, or as you say, made hay in San Francisco.
Right.
So what is it about satirization or satire that is linked to San Francisco?
First of all, about The Onion, I think that it only has a certain number of outlets in the country, and it was natural that San Francisco be one of them. So I think that's why it struck me to speak about The Onion, that even though it came out of Madison, you probably can't find it in that many places, and it makes sense that San Francisco is one of the places you can find it.
So most of the big cities, though, now, I think.
Yeah. I think that when you feel relatively powerless, but you have moral outrage and you know what your principles are, then I think that satire or irony or sarcasm, words in that family, naturally arise in you. Naturally arises in you to want to do some kind of satire. You may also... I was reading an interesting article about how few good political novels there are written by Americans. And I think that may be in part because if I'm going to say this exactly the way I mean it, but how powerless we feel as individuals, and therefore it doesn't even make sense to write a certain kind of political novel like a Solzhenitsyn might have written.
Actually, Barbara Kingsolver, who offers a big prize for a political novel, claims that a lot of it has to do with the fact that that American writers make too much of a dichotomy between art and politics, and that's really the key to it.
Yeah. Well, for whatever reasons, I think that some of the ways in which we express our natural intelligence and natural outrage is through satire. And so I think that's why, since San Francisco and the other great cities are meccas for individualism and freedom, they're also meccas for satire.
Well, you mentioned moral outrage and principles, and there's a moment in your book when you hit on both. You had a book party, and there's an accountant there who's a novelist, and he decides he's going to use his advance for publicity. You really took exception to this big time.
I did. It pained me. I write mostly nonfiction now. I wrote fiction, still do write fiction. It's, of course, the custom of the trade in nonfiction that a writer is obliged to, and it makes sense, is obliged to support his books in certain ways before and after the fact. And the main selling tool for the nonfiction writer is the thing called a nonfiction book proposal, where the writer expresses his marketing and promoting plan, and the marketing and promoting plan for nonfiction writers is virtually as important as the book idea or the writing itself. And I have grown easy enough with this way of being in the world. I understand that many nonfiction writers are selling their book primarily based on their platform and their ability to sell the book as opposed to the idea. I had hoped that fiction would stay pure and would remain the place where the words themselves would matter the most, and not whether you had a way of reaching lots of readers or could hire the right publicist after the fact or for reasons ancillary to the quality of the writing itself. It hasn't yet switched, I don't think. I don't think that there is yet something called the fiction proposal that fiction writers have to worry about writing. But I think the writing is on the wall that we may have to do that down the road and express to publishers how we're going to sell the books ourselves and be a little bit less concerned with the writing itself and more the selling.
I think actually at one point you hit upon a point that has often seemed self-evident to me, and that is it's difficult to often characterize fiction, one's own fiction. I mean, people will ask you, for example, if you're working on a novel, what's it about? And it's a pretty wide canvas, and it can be about so many things that to try to give this sort of niche to it.
That's right. There's a quote that I can't quite remember, but it's something like, to paraphrase a novel is ridiculous. And it feels ridiculous to the author to have to do that. But that, as a creativity coach, you ask, what do creativity coaches do? One of the things we do is help artists in all the different disciplines say what their work's about. Often visual artists have a terrible time creating their visual artist statement. It's often harder than making the paintings themselves, and for obvious reasons. But they have to be able to have that, whatever you want to call it, elevator speech or, you know, headline speech as to what they're doing so that they can communicate without anxiety and effortlessly to gallery owners or collectors or to other people they have to deal with. So that is one of our tasks in the arts, is being able to speak about the work we do.
Well, I'm going to open our phone lines and invite those of you listening to join this conversation. A lot, certainly, to discuss and address here with our guest, Eric Maisel. Why has the city always attracted writers, and what about the city as a writer's town? But also a larger question about artists in San Francisco, a bohemian mecca is what Eric Maisel calls it, and all those people with day jobs who are sort of maybe longing or yearning or lusting to be something of an artist, whether it's a visual artist or a writer, literary artist, whatever. You may want to comment on all that. And is this a satiric breeding ground? Maybe I'll also ask the question, are there no Republicans who enlist as opposed to Bohemians? Because Eric Maisel goes on record as saying, from his experience, having been in the service, he didn't know any Republicans who enlisted. Well, that's a whole other bag of worms. You can join us, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Again, our toll-free number for your calls is 866-733-6786, and we welcome your participation in this conversation. You can also email us. Email address here is forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with author, teacher, and creativity trainer and coach, Eric Maisel. His newest book, he's got 30 under his belt or so, is called A Writer San Francisco, A Guided Journey for the Creative Soul. And I was getting a little bit of background about his military service because I knew that he had been an acting platoon sergeant in Korea and writes about this at least fleetingly in the book, and found out that back in 65, 66, when most people were going to Vietnam, Eric went to Korea because he'd worked out a deal with the recruiters for himself to go to Korea, which nowadays wouldn't necessarily hold. I mean, you work out a deal not to go to Iraq, and many of these young people wind up there regardless.
That's right, and it was not a brilliant deal. I mean, one could enlist either for a specialty or for a destination. So I enlisted to go to Korea, not realizing that I could go to Vietnam right after Korea, but it just played itself out that I didn't have enough months left after Korea to be sent to Vietnam. And as you were saying, nowadays, even though technically I didn't have enough months, I would have been sent nowadays, it seems to me. But back then, they honored the agreement that one had to have, I think it was, 12 months left in order to be sent to Vietnam, and I had 11 months left. So the plan that I formulated at 18 actually worked out.
18, after flunking out of college, we should mention, because this is a man who now has 3 degrees and a couple of master's degrees as well as a BA, and 30 books under his belt. So those youth who feel perhaps that they're off track in terms of education or career, take heart. Also, take heart if you have lines that you've discarded. That's also something that comes across in your prose, the importance of any kind of touch of the artist that might manifest itself. It may come out in a different way that you didn't expect, maybe recycled or...
Right. The point of that essay that you're alluding to is that we writers lead a funny life. You're working on a given book and you're sitting in a cafe and a line comes to you that you like. What are you supposed to do with that line? Are you supposed to discard the book you're writing and start on the book that the line suggests? Or are you supposed to file it somewhere? And how do you file lines? And in fact, everyone who is a writer has the experience of having all kinds of words and phrases and lines and paragraphs and fragments floating around the house like ghosts in the house. And it's actually hard to deal with those things. It's hard to know what to make of the fleeting ideas that go by your mind, especially when you're working forthrightly on a given project. What do you do with all of these other thoughts?
There's a woman you profile in your book. I want to go to your calls in just a moment, but a rather poignant portrayal of a woman, young woman afflicted with schizophrenia called Carol in the book, who is a poet. And at one point, someone says to her, and it's more lucid time for her, you are a real poet. And that kind of validation is sort of the focus of this individual essay and this collection of essays that make up your book about how writers, artists of all kinds, need to often hear those words and can take really great heart and comfort sometimes in hearing those words. There's no guarantee, of course, if you do the work and
that's right.
Aspire to whatever.
And I think the flip side of it is how often we don't hear those words, how difficult it is to hear those words, because most people don't actually have a sufficient vocabulary of praise. The people we show work to often don't like to praise at that level, sometimes just out of a kind of seemliness. So they say, you know, I like it, or it's really good, or what have you. But that's not registering in our being as the right kind of praise. We need people to be telling us, of course, if they believe it, we need people to be telling us, you're a real writer. That's the language we need to hear, as opposed to, that's pretty good. And since most people won't praise us that way, it's entirely possible to go a whole lifetime never hearing the words we hope to hear.
And then again, sometimes you hear those words and they're not necessarily valid.
There's that. And if you become, of course, popular or a celebrity or one of those kinds of words, then you may be hearing that kind of stuff without it being justified at all.
Well, I guess it's no secret. I was an aspiring writer at one point in my life. I don't know if I'm a real writer. I don't think so. I think I'm a broadcaster and a teacher and a scholar, but I don't think I'm a real writer. And yet I was called a real writer because my writing maybe moved some people or hit their imagination a certain way or whatever.
Well, I would, of course, want to convince you that you want to change your cognition and feel like a real writer.
Oh, God, there's work there. Let's go to our callers from San Diego. Ramona, good morning.
Good morning. It's ironic. I lived in Berkeley for over 20-something years, and I found the writing community there to be very intimidating. And I moved to San Diego, and now my writing is flourishing. I'm published in several of the regional magazines, San Diego Magazine, San Diego Home and Garden. I have a column with them every month. And I'm also a photographer, which is how I broke into those magazines. And just by happenstance, I submitted some of my writing samples to a couple of the editors, and they were, why aren't you writing for us also? So I found the atmosphere in San Francisco to be somewhat prohibitive because I think that there's kind of I don't know the word for it. There seems to be this sense of you have to really suffer or agonize for your writing there. And if you don't hang out in cafes all day and, you know, hunkered over your computer or notepad or whatever, that you're not really a real writer, whereby here in San Diego I found the environment to be, to my advantage, a much more provincial place that allowed me to bring a different perspective to a place that's really starting to explode right now. I think San Diego is really coming into its own, and our workforce is much more educated now. It's becoming a very hip destination.
It sounds like you found the right place, at least for
really,
your abilities.
You know what? I found the right place in every regard except the community, which is a very conservative community. Mm-hmm. And as you might imagine, coming from Berkeley, you know, I'm used to much more diversity and a much more liberal perspective on things. So in that regard, I feel a little bit like a fish out of water here with my political perspectives.
But here's the rub on that, Ramona. That is, well, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I would actually like to piggyback on that, and that is, although this book tries to sell the idea that San Francisco is an excellent place for writers, and I believe that to be the case, most of my writing sells the different idea that you have to write wherever you are, and that's really how to live an authentic life, is that you write wherever you happen to find yourself. And you don't really need cafes. Cafes may be a luxury or even some kind of necessity, but in fact, what's most important is that you have your kitchen table and your pad and your pen, and you do your work wherever you find yourself.
Cafes can be a diversion, too. You can wind up talking about your writing and talking it out as opposed to doing the work that's necessary, or that's true for any art.
That's right, and I really don't want to romanticize the cafe culture or cafe life, because what I more talk about in my books than cafe life and sort of the idealization of the out-of-doors writer is the fact that we have to do our work exactly where we find ourselves and do it first thing each day if we're smart.
I think it was someone no less than Faulkner who said it doesn't matter where you are, and it shouldn't matter where you are. You don't need community to be a writer. You know, you can live in Oxford, Mississippi, up in a room with your booze and your pad and pencil, and that's all you
And be an alcoholic. No, I think it does matter where you are, but I think where you are is not a in AA, it's called the geographic fallacy, namely, I'll be sober over there. I can't be sober here. I'll be sober if I move to X place or Y place. So we don't want to operate from the geographic fallacy, namely, I can't write here. I could only write over there. You know, so we don't want to be operating that way. But it is important where we live. I mean, I think places do have distinct differences, and we are probably happier in one place than another. But whether we're happier or not is not the bottom line. The bottom line is that we get our work done.
Don't you think, though, true artists, if there is such a thing, and those who are committed to their art, are going to find a way somehow to bring it out, to manifest it, regardless of where they are, regardless of, you know, the pressures in their lives or whatever?
I don't actually believe that. I think that harmful criticism, early childhood experiences, there are a whole array of experiences that can easily, not just prevent, but that can easily prevent a very creative person from ever manifesting his or her potential. I think that there's such a fine line between being able to open up to our imagination and being prevented from opening up because we have old injunctions and old messages about not being worthy or whatever the old messages are.
That's the therapist in you. I understand that. But there are people who are driven by those ghosts and those devils and that lack of sufficiency of self or ego and so forth, that disapproval to create and create something that's lasting and enduring that can overcome that.
I agree with that. But I also know from my own experience in working with many clients over time that there are people who probably never would have manifested their creative potential had they not been helped a little. In other words, they were on a path. They always had it in them to do the work, but they were on a path to never do the work. And so from that point of view, I believe it's entirely possible to have it in you to do the work and to actually spend your whole lifetime never having done the work, and that you can turn that around with a creativity coach or just through mindful self-reflection. Through inner work, you can get yourself to the position where you can do the creative work you always could have done.
We'll go to more calls. And Ray, good morning.
Yes, good morning. I wanted to ask Eric if he could compare, you know, what I guess I think of the glory days in the 60s with Ferlinghetti and Kerouac and the magnet San Francisco was for writers. And I was concerned with versus today, with the huge influx of money and commercialization. Has there been an exodus of writers and artists, or is it as big a magnet as it ever was for writers?
I think those are actually two different questions. As to it being as big a magnet, I think it is. I think it absolutely is as big a magnet.
As the Beat era was, really?
I think so. I think something like our Litquake event was one of those proofs of how many writers are here working. And I have all kinds of sort of anecdotal understanding of how many writers are working here. But ask that other question about whether being a writer in the 60s was a different experience from being a writer today. From my own point of view, I think it absolutely was. I mean, it seems to me, and it's really hard to talk about being one age versus being 40 years older, but I was much more of an engaged activist in the 60s than I am now, and I suspect that the whole country is like that. All the different generations are less engaged and there's less activism going on than was going on in the 60s. So it feels to me like a different era. I preferred the 60s to now in the sense of the way we were standing up then and are not standing up now.
There's also the sense of, and Ray, thank you for the call, of change that went on during the boom, for example. It was so expensive to live in the Bay Area, and many artists just migrated out of an economic necessity. So what had once been a mecca for bohemians was undergoing some severe face changes.
That's absolutely true, but I think that there's a way where even if you're, so to speak, across the Bay, if you're living in places like Emeryville or other places we could name that are cheaper than San Francisco, by being in proximity to San Francisco and by still being in the Bay Area, you still get to reap the benefits of being here. This is true of all the great cities, whether it's New York, London, Paris. In Paris, you move from one arrondissement to another according to how the prices are going, and then you start to move right outside the perimeter to the suburbs and what have you. So intellectuals or writers, creative people are always moving according to what they can afford, but they tend to want to stay in touch with that central base of the great city.
And we go from one Ray to another Ray. This Ray joining us from Sacramento. Good morning.
Yeah, as a writer, I was wondering if you were familiar with the Ira Progoff intensive journal keeping system and how utilizing that to kind of personify work or issues and in one's past. Are you familiar with that at all?
I know of it, but I do have something to say about it, even though I hardly know it. And that is, and I'm much more familiar with The Artist's Way, which is a popular book and also has a certain kind of exercise base to it, just as Ira Progoff's work does. And I would issue a cautionary note that it's very easy to do that kind of journaling work and avoid doing our real work of writing. And of course, I'm not saying that's what you're saying, but I work with lots of clients who turn over a substantial portion of their life to things like journaling as opposed to actually getting on with their novel. And I try to cut them off from some of that over time or wean them from some of that writing that isn't the real writing but is more peripheral writing.
And then again, they can look at Anais Nin and other writers and say, well, good journal writing gets published sometimes, doesn't it?
Only occasionally, and I think you need a Henry Miller fighting for publication. I mean, I think that's a really interesting example because she was not really interested in publication, as many journal writers are not. And it was Henry Miller who said this is the most important document of our century. And
he tend to speak in superlatives, didn't he?
Yes.
Eric DeJong's Fear of Flying, he said one of the greatest novels ever. By the way, you can join us here with Eric Maisel if you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius Satellite by calling into our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or emailing us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. And Peter joins us. Morning, Peter.
Good morning. I should live in San Francisco, but I live in a wasteland. So I'd like to ask your guest, with somewhat tongue-in-cheek, what should I write about if I live in San Jose?
Well, we don't write about the place we're in, so you would probably be writing the same thing whether you're in San Jose or San Francisco, namely the things that are really on your mind. And I think that's important for us to remember, is that wherever we are, we're writing about matters that are important to us.
But place is certainly always important, particularly in fiction writing. After all, you call it a wasteland. There was a guy named Thomas Stearns Eliot who wrote something really quite extraordinary in its effect on 20th century literature called The Wasteland. I mean, why not write about San Jose?
Exactly. And I think for fiction
it's
writers...
It's not a wasteland. We've got plenty of listeners there.
That's right.
Take exception to that.
And for fiction writers, setting is as big an idea as plot, character, theme, and the other elements of craft. And I think setting sort of gets short shrift in the fiction writer's mind. And we love the settings of places. The settings of places are often what mesmerizes the most. going down the Mississippi with Huck Finn. The places we grew up learning about through fiction are sometimes more real to us than the places we actually live in. So I think you can create setting wherever you are and make that setting memorable if you're inclined to do that.
But you have people probably who come to you and say, I feel I want to be creative. What should I be doing? Or I want to be a writer. What should I be writing about? I mean, they begin in the most incoherent way like that.
That's right.
How do you move them forward? What do you do?
Well, the first question is, what would you like to be writing about? I mean, I have to ask the question all over again, because almost always there is something that they've been meaning to write about or paint about or whatever. There is something they've been meaning to do. They just like to present themselves as if they have no particular ideas, but in fact, they've been gestating something or percolating something for a long time. And then my next question is, well, what about that piece? Is that still of interest to you? And so we'll go down the line of seeing whether the thing that has always been on their mind is still of interest to them. If in fact nothing is on their mind, if nothing has been percolating, then I would go to that cognitive place of asking them to generate a list of potential ideas, the longer the list, the possible, essentially brainstorming work, and then have them rank order that list. In other words, there are techniques and practical things that can get anybody better in tune with what they're wanting to create.
We had a program a while back, in fact, many, many requests for tapes and many hits on our archive website on writer's block, and a lot of techniques, of course, to diminish writer's block. And you've talked about inducing creativity and helping to induce creativity through mindfulness and through detachment, through things that are often associated with Buddhism. What else is a real way to induce creativity?
Sure. Well, I make a distinction in my own mind. It may not be necessarily an important distinction, but in my own mind, I make a distinction between writer's block and resistance, everyday resistance. I think writer's block is often about something going on, but everyday resistance is the thing we have to overcome every day, even if nothing in particular is going on, in order to write. And so I have what's essentially an exercise in A Writer of San Francisco, which is the breaking the egg exercise. And this has no religious or spiritual connection. It's a very practical exercise. It seems to me that the experience we go through of moving from not writing to writing is an experience very similar to breaking an egg for no good reason. Everybody can break an egg and not feel squeamish about it if they're breaking an egg in order to bake a cake. You just crack it on the side of the bowl and you break it and you drop it in, and you don't feel any particular discomfort in doing that. But if I were to ask you to break an egg for no good reason, you'd go, ooh, I really don't want to do that. I don't like that sensation of doing it. And there's something about moving to our writing from a place of not writing that is something like that. There's some squeamishness going on inside of ourselves. So I actually have the coaches I train spend a week breaking an egg, doing their work, and then, because the second problem is that we leave our writing too quickly. First problem is we don't get to our writing. Second problem is we leave our writing too quickly. I then, instead of getting up and running out of the apartment, I have them stir the egg in the bowl beside their computer and use that as a kind of method or technique for staying put.
Wait, these are people who come to you? Or you said training coaches? Are you training coaches?
I do. I've trained 400 or 500 creativity coaches over the last 4 or 5 years. And so I teach them the techniques that have worked for me, and that's one of the techniques that I teach, is this cracking an egg technique.
And on we go to Arizona, Cornville, Arizona. Bill, welcome.
Welcome. Michael, thank you very much. Great show again. I wanted to get back to a little bit to the idea you talked about a few minutes ago about getting permission to write and how important that is. And I thought the most amazing example I've ever heard of that was W.S. Merwin, and he told me some stories about it personally, but he writes about it very succinctly, I think, in The Maze of Ventadone, a book he did for National Geographic, about his trip to visit Ezra Pound when Pound was still incarcerated in New York.
St. Elizabeth's Hospital, in fact.
Yeah. Right, and it was basically, Pound gave him permission to set out on a lifetime of trying to be a great poet. And it was, when I heard that story, I thought, my gosh, you know, this is what it takes. You need someone that you look up to, that you trust, that you admire to do this. I can see how this is very, very important.
But, of course, you can't wait for someone else to give you that permission. You may never meet the Pound. I mean,
no,
I met Saul Bellow. He said, you can be a great novelist like me. It didn't work out that way. Merwin is a pretty talented guy.
I'm of course, essentially agreeing with you, but, of course, right. We have to give ourselves that permission. That's right. The work.
But I guess I would encourage young writers maybe to read about Merwin's experience, mm-hmm. and not to be afraid to go and seek, you know, counsel from great writers, man. And Pound was famous for this, wasn't he? Didn't he?
I mentioned Eliot before. He was Eliot's mentor, and he was a mentor to so many writers. Yeah.
Right. But I think that you were on to something, and to me, it made a huge difference. And something I'm trying to do with my daughter, who, you know, is 14 and tries to write poetry. It's like, you know, if someone, you know, outside her world who she really admired sort of gave her permission to continue it on a serious level, it would make a difference in her life. I just see that as a father. So thanks again for the show, and that's my comment.
Thanks, Bill, for the comment.
And I want to agree, and yet I really want to throw out the cautionary note. I think it's important not to look for people who are going to validate us. I think it's really important that we look to ourselves primarily. A lot of young artists try to show up at the doorstep of somebody, and that somebody is not interested or is drunk or is something, and they don't get that validation, and they don't have the way of validating themselves. So of primary importance is validating ourselves.
The internal validation, I agree, is primary. In fact, I mentioned Faulkner before. You know that story about Faulkner going to see Sherwood Anderson, who was like a mentor to him, and saying he had written Soldier's Pay, his first published novel, and he said, I want you to help me, and I admire your work, and so forth. And the story was that Anderson said, I'll help you get the work published, only one condition. I don't want to read the work.
Exactly.
I don't want to bother with it.
Exactly.
And did help him get it published.
And that speaks to how sometimes the gods of whimsy have to be on our side, and how much luck is involved in this process. And, of course, we want to help luck with our perseverance, but it is also the case that there is a lot of luck involved in the process. The Dostoevsky story comes to mind. He happened to be living with a roommate when he wrote his first novel, and the roommate knew Russia's most famous critic at that time, Belyinsky, and Dostoevsky's roommate rushed his first novel over to Belyinsky, who loved it. But without that roommate, you know, how was Dostoevsky going to get the novel to that critic? So sometimes just those sorts of things need to happen for us to progress.
Well, you tell a story in the book about beloved former friend of mine, he's since died, and wonderful teacher and novelist named Herb Wilner, and how he missed having his book reviewed in the New York Times. It's a story actually worth telling because it's, again, the capriciousness of things and how they go.
It's poignant, and it is about the capriciousness, and it's also about how, if it's at all possible, we want to not have all of our eggs in one basket. So Herb Wilner
cracked some of them too.
Exactly. So Herb Wilner had written a novel, and
it was all the Little Heroes, I think. Wasn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. And he went away for the weekend, and when he returned, it wasn't a time of voicemail, so I'm not quite sure how this would have worked. I don't remember the story precisely, but he learned that the reviewer for the New York Times Book Review had been in town, and if he had been able to reach Herb, would have reviewed the book, but because he wasn't able to reach Herb, didn't review the book. And Herb Wilner always felt that that was the difference between not only that book being successful or more successful than it was, but somehow that affected his whole writing career negatively.
There's also the story about Oprah that you tell, too.
Right. I have an acquaintance who is a small publisher, runs a small publishing house down south in the state. And he went to a conference one weekend, a Los Angeles book conference, and decided to just stay away from his voicemail over the weekend. He wanted to be free of the kinds of voicemails and emails and messages that he had all week long, so he shut off his phone. And when he got back, there was a voicemail from Oprah's producer saying, one of your books really interests us. We want to have the guest on. We're going to give the guest the whole hour. Please get back to me right away. Now, this was 3 days later, and he got back to the producer, and they'd already moved on to another subject. And he always felt that that prevented that book from being a bestseller and really hurt his whole publishing house.
Now, you've written 30 books. Have you written about your father at all? I mean, other than mentioning him like in an essay here and there, because you didn't really know him, I know. And
that's right. I think only in the essay here, it seems to me that only in the essay here do I mention him much at all.
So I would think that that would be not necessarily a burning interest, but something that you'd want to find out more about.
It wasn't of interest. When I was very young, probably 12, 13, 14, I read Sartre's autobiography, Les Mots, The Words, and he didn't know his father, and he was always glad of that. And he had a line that went something like, fathers always lay full length on their sons, and he was glad not to have a father lay full length on him.
But you found out later in life that your father had been a writer, that there were...
Yes, but by looking around at my peers when I was young, I felt they were all harmed by having fathers. Now, of course, I've got to quickly say I don't mean fathers aren't useful, good, and all those things. But when their fathers came home at 5 or 6, a certain severity and punishing energy would enter the households around me. And I didn't want that. I didn't need that. And I was not interested in learning who my father was.
That's curious in itself to me. I mean, I know people who have felt the way you have about fathers as well as mothers that they didn't mm-hmm. know, but you would think that some of the creative curiosity would, particularly even just what the genetic links might have been, but you are who you are. And thank you. I'm glad you are who you are. Eric Maisel with us this hour, author of A Writer's San Francisco, A Guided Journey for the Creative Soul. He's going to be appearing at Borders Books at the end of January, and... the book is out and available.
Right.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
We will be with you again tomorrow, and if everything goes according to plan, we'll be talking about parenting and temperament in the opening hour of tomorrow's program. And then we'll hear from some people who took part in this J. Allison program with National Public Radio, what I believe, some local people on that score. That's tomorrow's program. We hope you will join us. We appreciate you joining us Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and certainly appreciate your listenership. Want to extend thanks to our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mall, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory, with production assistance from Leah Wellborn today. And our engineer is David Freeman. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Thank you for being here. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.